WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is a round anniversary year of sorts in New Jersey. It has now been 40 years since the landmark Mount Laurel ruling that requires every town in the state to provide affordable housing for low-income people. Governor Christie has called that law an abomination that needs to be overturned. So right now, a look at that Mount Laurel ruling 40 years later and the state of affordable housing in New Jersey with Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, and Douglas Massey, Princeton sociologist, who has a new study on the effects of Mount Laurel. He's the author of many books. He's probably most well known for American Apartheid, Segregation, and the Making of the Underclass. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks, Brian. Okay.
Great, thank you.
And Nancy, very briefly explain Mount Laurel to the uninitiated, what it mandates and what it sought to do.
So Mount Laurel is a town in South Jersey. It's basically a suburb of Philadelphia. And what was happening in the 50s and 60s is it was transforming from a rural area to a suburban area. And there was a historic African-American community there, as there are in many New Jersey communities, that was being priced out. As the suburbs were being built and the prices were rising, they couldn't afford to buy a home. So a group there tried to build an affordable apartment building or complex, and the town turned them down. They said, no, we're zoning this land for single-family houses, and turned them down. So this group was led by a woman named Ethel Lawrence. They sued the town. 40 years ago, they won in Superior Court, and then it went to the New Jersey Supreme Court in 1972, and the court said the towns could not zone against affordable housing and should create it. And then in 1983, it has been litigated so many times. And now then in 1983, the Supreme Court went a step further and said towns have an obligation to provide affordable housing.
Did they say how much or how?
Well, no. And then what happened was the Council on Affordable Housing was created by the legislature to figure this out and mandate it and regulate the towns. And you just can't even believe the number of lawsuits and the red tape and how bogged down it has become. It worked for a while, and about 65,000 units of affordable housing were built. But it has come pretty much to a standstill. Christie tried to kill it this past year, and he's been overruled, and now he's taking that issue to the Supreme Court.
Wait, 65,000 units of affordable housing in 40 years?
It's not that big of a number, is it?
In a state with how many people?
Don't ask me that number.
Here is Governor Christie talking about trying to dismantle the Council on Affordable Housing, the agency that you mentioned that administers the Mount Laurel law.
We promised that when we ran for office, and we've worked hard over the first 5 months with Senator Lesniak to put together a bipartisan bill that returns the issue of affordable housing back to the localities where it belongs and turns it into something that is market-driven, not artificial numbers and quotas that come from some bureaucrat in Trenton sitting in the cubicle somewhere.
So Governor Christie versus the Council on Affordable Housing and, by extension, the Mount Laurel ruling that has been so complicated for the state. So, Professor Massey, I guess the governor successfully shut down the agency last summer, but only to have it revived in March by an appeals court?
That's correct. He's very much against it, but the courts so far have held firm. It's a 40-year-old doctrine at this point, and it's a constitutional issue under the New Jersey Constitution.
Why has it been so unsuccessful if it's only created 60,000 units of affordable housing in all these years?
Well, a lot of the municipalities around New Jersey dig in their feet and throw up roadblock after roadblock after roadblock, both in the courts and in planning meetings, and try to slow down the process and prevent the construction of housing.
You did a study that shows that NIMBY fears, not in my backyard fears, of affordable housing and the blight that that might bring to nearby neighborhoods don't actually play out. Tell us what you found.
Well, the housing project in Mount Laurel was finally built and actually opened to residents in 2000, 30 years after the original lawsuit was filed. And we took that opportunity to do a study to see what effect the opening of what is now known as the Ethel Lawrence Homes had on Mount Laurel as a community and had on surrounding neighborhoods. And we looked at tax rates, we looked at property values, and we looked at crime rates, and we compared Mount Laurel to other nearby townships that are very similar in composition but don't have a 100% affordable housing project. And basically, we found no effect. We couldn't find any effect on trends in property rates, crime rates, or house values. So the great fears that were articulated never came to pass.
So listeners in New Jersey, any Mount Laurel calls, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Scott in Sussex County, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. How are you doing?
Good.
I live in Sussex County, and I benefit from the ruling in Mount Laurel. I currently live in what would be considered low-income housing. But I think one thing that people think about when they think of low-income housing is that a project is just, what they think of as a building, a housing project, is going to just pop up in the middle of their nice town. For instance, I live in Sparta, New Jersey, which is has quite a lot of money for towns in the area, and I know that was one concern in my town. However, what they found is that apartments were actually built without low-income housing, and what programs have done in the area is then they offer, it's a new building, and they offer you, $200 or $300 off your rent through the program. So it's not necessarily like the building is an eyesore, and the program certainly helped me. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you very much. So he's the one, Nancy.
Well,
who's
actually
been helped by this?
Yeah, there's a little bit more than one. And I visited one of these affordable housing complexes in Morristown, which was also in a historic African-American community that has seen its numbers of units shrink. And that particular neighborhood in Morristown. Anyway, it was a beautiful building. It looked just like any other suburban apartment complex. And they're providing housing for about half the cost of the market rate.
So, Professor Massey, what positive outcomes have the Ethel Lawrence Homes had, these projects in Mount Laurel Township, beyond providing housing itself that's affordable to low-income people? Has it improved people's earnings potential? Did the schools get better? Were there economic benefits to a town, more racial harmony? Or don't even ask those questions, and it's just about, being able to afford your housing?
Well, we asked all those questions, and the answer to all the questions you put was highly affirmative, that the chance to move into a nice, affordable housing project in an affluent and privileged suburb dramatically improved the lives of the people who took advantage of this program. They had higher employment rates, much higher earnings, lower rates of welfare use, better mental health, lower exposure to crime and disorder and violence, fewer negative life events in their daily lives. And their children attended markedly better schools. They earned grades that were equal to or better than they would have earned had they not moved. And they were exposed to a lot less disorder and violence within the schools. So it seems like a win-win for everybody. It helped a lot of people with a path out of poverty. It didn't cost the taxpayers anything. And it didn't have any negative effects on the surrounding neighborhoods.
Greg in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
I'm all right. What's up?
Well, there's a part of this whole law that allows affluent towns to, instead of building affordable housing, to give money to towns, and the town I live in happens to be one of them, to either build more affordable housing or rehab old homes. So there's several affluent towns who said, oh, we don't want to build that affordable housing, so we'll pay this other town to do it. And this seems to me that's one of the goofy things about our government and the way we write laws.
The way
they're interpreted by the different entities.
Uh-huh.
So the different towns and the different courts and the different systems.
Right. Thank you. So is this like, I don't know, carbon credits? One town can trade with another town to take their affordable housing requirement?
Right. And it's one of the highly contentious issues with the Council on Affordable Housing. They've also, I spoke with someone at the League of Municipalities, which hates the Council on Affordable Housing. And, you know, and he was saying that they came up with a formula that looked at what land was developable in each town and then set goals for a quota of how much housing they would be required to build. But in some of these towns, the land that was supposedly developable was, there were cemeteries, there was open space, there was preserved farmland, there was even the median strip of the Garden State Parkway for one town. So there, and even housing advocates will acknowledge that there have been a lot of problems with COA and with these current regulations, which have there are 20 lawsuits alone just about the 2008 COA obligation regulations.
And I guess the larger context, Professor Massey, before you go, there's been a lot of research about the effects of affordable housing in urban areas, but not so much in the suburbs. And I gather you're looking at it because the geography of poverty is changing in our area. More people who are poor live in the suburbs, and there's a decrease in concentration of poverty in inner cities, right?
That's right. But before I answer that, I want to clear something up.
Sure.
What the last caller was talking about was something called the Regional Concentration Agreement, which did allow affluent municipalities just to ship off their affordable housing obligations to other towns or cities. But that provision was outlawed and repealed at the end of the Corzine administration, and he signed it into law. So that practice can no longer happen.
Let's get one more caller in here who sees effects in his neighborhood from Mount Laurel. Len, where are you?
Fairhill, New Jersey.
Okay, and what's happening there?
There's a section of town called Radburn. There's a large parcel of land that was a park and other open area, and they want to sell it, and the developer's using the ruling to basically foist upon the town against most of the citizens the fact that we have to put in high density and COA development, and it's really going to be the last large tract of land in town. And it's basically we don't at this point seem to be able to win, from what I've been following on the case. And
why do you want to keep the density out of town?
Oh, we don't want to keep. We got a lot of apartment buildings in town. This is the only one that's going to be, as far as I know, under this ruling, and the last open park owned by this section of town, so they have the right to do what they want of it. But the bottom line is it's just that there's a lot of high density in town. This is just a large complex with no parking and no access to streets. It's going to kill the neighborhood around it. It's basically, and the rules being, the goals are laudable, but its implementation is heavy-handed. So.
Right. And, Nancy, did the developers actually make money on building low-income housing in the way that Len seems to be describing?
Well, they want more density. They want to build more units. And so they're willing to trade. They're happy to put in some low affordable units so that they can just build a bigger complex.
I see. The whole complex wouldn't necessarily be affordable. It's that they can make a deal for a 90-10 or an 80-20 or something like that.
Right. And what created the climate in which there's been so much litigation over these regulations is that at some point, this thing called a builder's remedy emerged, in which it allows, if a town zones against a builder wanting to create some of this density, they're able, through Mount Laurel, to require the town to give them that complex with, I think, I can't remember the ratio, but it's something like, you know, one out of every 10 units would be affordable, and that allows them to sort of go around the zoning regulation.
So end with this, if you would, Professor Massey. Comment on our webpage, where does it end? Since when does anyone have a right to live in an expensive town? Do I have a right to drive a Mercedes?
Well, the real question is, does the developer have a right to put up housing in a way he sees fit on a land that he owns or controls or is optioned? The idea that housing markets are somehow free is really mistaken. It's housing markets, real estate is the most regulated market in the country, and it's really a question of whose interests are served by the way the market works. And basically, towns are using those local zoning ordinances in order to prevent the entry of children, to prevent the entry of poorer families, and wall themselves off from the rest of society.
Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio. Douglas Massey, Princeton sociologist who has a new study on the effects of the Mount Laurel housing ruling in New Jersey. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we will meet philanthropist Eli Broad next. You might say he's kind of the Michael Bloomberg of Los Angeles, except the mayor part. Stay with us.